Tonight on this recorded edition of Extension 720, a visit with an old friend who talks about some still older friends. Richard Brookhiser, a well-established historian and popular writer, the author of many important biographical studies of the Founding Fathers, of various Founding Fathers, has now done a book titled What Would the Founders Do? Our Questions, Their Answers. So you are, to use the modern vocabulary, interrogating the founders.
Yes, I am.
I've got one I want you to put to them right away.
Okay.
Because it's utterly current. In fact, we spent this program last night in real time, that is on the night of the 26th of June, focused on this matter, the New York Times matter, and the criticism of the Times for releasing that story, disclosing so much about the way in which we are pursuing international banking connections, serving the interests of terrorist organizations. So it's the question of the press and of press freedom versus press responsibility, isn't
Well,
did the question arise at the time of the revolution and beyond?
They certainly wouldn't have been surprised by a newspaper doing such a thing. You know, there was no notion of journalistic objectivity in the late 18th century. None at all. It was just assumed that newspapers were partisan organs. The divide, there were sort of high-end ones which were partisan but not necessarily wall-to-wall lies, and then, you know, low-end ones which were partisan and wall-to-wall lies. But that was sort of the choice you had. In terms of ferreting out government secrets, you know, there were many fewer to ferret out, and especially having to do with military campaigns, because, you know, just the complexity and the speed, the rapidity was much lower. But certainly newspapers ran stories in which they said, you know, for instance, that President Adams had arms in the White House, arms in his presidential mansion in Philadelphia, that he was planning to marry his son to one of George III's daughters, that he was planning to found a dynasty, that various people, including Alexander Hamilton, were on the take of Britain. You know, they were getting money from the British Secret Service.
This sounds like the Enquirer.
Well, and yet, some of these stories have had long legs. The story about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings first appeared in 1802.
In what paper, actually?
It was a Richmond paper that had been founded by the journalist, a man named James Callender. And he'd come from Scotland, and he had become a journalistic warrior for Thomas Jefferson on his side. And he was attacking the Adams administration. He was attacking Alexander Hamilton. And Jefferson was paying him small, he'd slip him small sums of money, you know, to keep him afloat. Then Jefferson wins the election of 1800. And Callender makes it known that he'd like to be a postmaster. You know, he'd like such a job. And he approaches James Madison, the Secretary of State. And I don't know if they'd figured out who they were dealing with or if it's just they no longer needed him, but he doesn't get his postmastership.
And so he vows revenge.
Well, he vows revenge. He moves to Richmond, you know, sets up a newspaper, goes sniffing around for gossip, and he finds the Sally Hemings story, first published in 1802 and still, you know, marching on. So, you know, a lot of these scandals and stories we've forgotten, but some of them had at least part of the truth, or it's debatable what truth they have, and so they still preoccupy
that
us.
That leads in interesting further directions, it seems to me. One might well ask, I do ask, how did Jefferson's colleagues, the other lasting founders and other important politicians of the time, react to the Hemings story when it was first released? And what that brings to mind as well as a modern question is how would they have responded to the Lewinsky affair?
Well, it's interesting that the Hemings story got picked up very quickly by the New York Evening Post, which still exists as the New York Post. And this was Alexander Hamilton's newspaper that he founded to uphold federalism in New York. And it appeared, and then very shortly after, there was a little notice apologizing for its appearance. And saying that, you know, we should not be trafficking in such stuff. Now, Hamilton had had his own, sexual story a few years earlier, the whole Maria Reynolds
Oh, goodness,
affair.
yes. Yeah.
Yes, where he had felt compelled to reveal that he'd been paying blackmail to this husband-wife team of blackmailers, because the alternative story was that he'd been involved in insider trading, and that's why he was giving money to James Reynolds. Actually, he was sleeping with Mrs. Reynolds and paying off the husband for his silence. So
well, the husband had sort of set that up, hadn't
Oh,
he?
Yeah. Oh, it was a plan. I mean,
sort of a big con operation.
Sure. It was a badger game, and his wife's job was to meet rich and powerful people and, entangle them, mm-hmm. and then he'd put the bite on them. And they got, an interesting animal they bagged. John Adams's reaction to the Sally Hemings story was to begin a memoir where he assured his family, who he assumed would read this, that no woman would ever have cause to blush because of anything that John Adams had done, that he had never, had any illegitimate children, that, his record was
Now,
absolutely pure.
Why did he feel the need to do that? Was Abigail ever doubtful of his loyalty?
They were separated for many years.
Yeah.
And
by virtue of the distance between Washington and Boston.
Well,
or rather, Philadelphia and Boston.
Well, and even more, Paris and Boston.
As ambassador, to be sure.
That's right. And his letters became less and less frequent, and she complained of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I have never read anything that he had any romantic entanglements. I just don't believe he had. But I think, he'd known Jefferson years ago. They'd been friendly. He must have still liked them, even though they had now feuded. And I think this whole story disturbed him deeply, and he just wanted to, put on the record, this is not me.
Mm-hmm.
This is not me.
Well, I bring you forward then to just about 10 years ago, to the Lewinsky
mm-hmm.
affair. Not merely what happened in that room off the Oval Office, but the way in which the president played it, and particularly his, what has to be directly labeled as his lying to the grand jury.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know what Washington would have thought of lying to the grand jury. He says in his farewell address, there's a paragraph in there on the role of religion and morality in public life. And of course, he is a believer in the First Amendment and that there shall be no establishment of religion at the national level. But he does say that religion and morality are necessary in sustaining habits of citizenship. And he says a politician who would ignore this is foolish. And then he gives an instance. And the instance he gives is oaths in court.
Mm-hmm.
He says if there is no religious sanction to the oaths we swear in court, what good is a judicial system? It becomes mm-hmm. meaningless. So I feel from that I know what he would have thought of a politician, not much less a president, lying under oath in a legal matter.
Some people felt that way, back 225 years ago, but some people felt that way at the occasion with regard to Clinton and his perjury before the grand jury. But this has been variously described, quote, he got away with it, but we've grown more mature as a nation. We understand that peccadilloes happen. We understand
mm-hmm.
that sometimes your public role requires that you fudge things. After all, they lied to us about a great deal else. Why not allow the
mm-hmm.
president to lie when he's caught in such a tight situation of
mm-hmm.
embarrassment?
Well, I mean, certainly what Hamilton did in the similar situation, and we were just touching on
yeah.
it, he reveals to the nation in a 95-page pamphlet that he's been carrying on with a married woman while he is married, and there are apologies to his wife in this pamphlet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, it's discomforting reading even now. And a lot of his friends were astonished that he did this thing.
Well, we seem to have started with sex. I wasn't planning that, but that's where we first alighted. Let's come to something else of tremendous pertinence in our present day, and it is the war that we're now engaged in, and that very special kind of war. It's a war against terrorism, though it is also being fought in a country, Iraq, whose ruler we knocked over, and we're now trying to pacify that nation and establish, quote, a democracy. Is this so modern a situation that our founding fathers would not have comprehended it?
Well, they certainly knew of rogue nations.
Mm-hmm.
And there were four rogue nations, Islamic ones, as it happens, in North Africa, which the first four presidents had to deal with. And these were the Barbary states,
mm-hmm.
Morocco, Tunis, Algiers, and Tripoli, which is now Libya.
The basic trouble they gave us was piracy, is that right?
Yes, and they ran an extortion racket.
Mm-hmm.
And it was under the cover of how we treat infidels, but it was really how we treat infidels' pocketbooks, you know. And if you paid them off up front, they'd leave you alone. And if you hadn't made such arrangements, they'd, you know, capture your ships and ransom your crews. And this was serious slavery. The people who were on ransom spent their lives toiling in North Africa. So long as we were colonies of Britain, we profited from whatever arrangements Britain had made with these countries. But then when we become independent, all of a sudden, we're on our own. And George Washington and John Adams, their approach is to negotiate with these countries, largely because we have no navy. So there's nothing else we can do, so they sign a treaty. And it's negotiated under Washington, ratified and signed by John Adams. Then in 1801, Jefferson comes in as the third country and president. And shortly after he's in, the Basha of Tripoli cuts down the American flag in front of the American consulate. And this is the way you declared war in that part of the world. Now, his motive for doing that, he's the first person ever to declare war on us, first foreign country. He wanted to raise his prices. And this was his attention-getting way of saying, you know, my price has gone way up. Well, Jefferson
sounds like a touch of Ahmadinejad.
Jefferson was the wrong guy to do that with, because in his career as a diplomat, part of his portfolio as minister to Paris and France had been trying to make arrangements with the Barbary states. So he knew these guys from way back, and he deeply disliked them. And now he has a navy, because John Adams has built one. Not to fight the Barbary states, but to fight France. We thought we might go to war with France. So now we have a small but excellent navy, and Jefferson sends it to the Mediterranean. And it's a long, it lasts several years. There's some defeats, there's some victories. The Marine Corps hymn gets to the halls of Tripoli from one of the exploits.
Mm-hmm.
And
from the shores of Montezuma to the halls of Tripoli.
That's right.
How does the Montezuma get into it?
I think that would be the Mexican War.
Yeah.
So it's a conflation of two eras. So, but by our march to Tripoli across the Egyptian desert, this so alarms the Basha that he decides to settle and lower his prices. And Jefferson takes that deal. He thinks that's an acceptable
mm-hmm.
deal. This is 1805. But by 1812, they're up to their old tricks again, James Madison now being president. And we are involved in a war with Britain, the War of 1812, so we're preoccupied. But as soon as that ends, in 1815, Madison sends a second navy, there's a second Barbary War, and then we finally get them to pay damages to us. And that ends the problem as far as we're concerned.
Are there any intimations back then, as we looked towards the Barbary shores and towards the so-called Barbary pirates, and we knew that they were Muslim, are there any intimations back then of the Sam Huntington theme that has emerged in recent years of, quote, a clash of civilizations? In this instance, a clash between Islam on the one hand and Christendom on the other.
Not so far as I know among the founders. I know that John Adams's son, John Quincy Adams,
mm-hmm.
does think about this in The Next Generation as Greece is freeing itself from Turkey and the Turkish Empire is beginning, you know, to break
mm-hmm.
up This is the first major crack in it. And he has some thoughts on Islam in the modern world and what that is going to be like. But not for the founders, apart from this war, it's still mostly over their horizon.
Your new book, Richard Brookhiser, is titled What Would the Founders Do? Our Questions, Their Answers. It is published by
Basic Books.
By Basic Books. It's got a wonderful picture on the cover. The boys are in the tavern. There's George Washington hoisting a tankard. Ben Franklin is sitting there. Hamilton, etc. Where are they? Does that reflect a real occasion in life?
No, it's a modern a bar. There's a TV behind them. So they're back. I mean, they're back here to answer our questions, deal with our problems.
Well, I would be fascinated by your reflections on what they would see as they walked out of that modern bar, and what, or even as they watched that television, what sense they would make of what we are right now as a nation, as a people. And I shall press on with that question after we pause for these words. And we return to Richard Brookhiser, an old friend who's been here many times before. As an historian, he's done a number of books that have won wide popularity. I've got the list right in front of me. The Outside Story, that was about modern politics, how the Democrats and Republicans reelected Reagan. The Way of the Wasp, how it made America and how it can save it, so to speak. And then we get into the founders' territory. Founding Father, Rediscovering George Washington, Rules of Civility, I love that one, the subtitle, and I remember our talking about it, the 120 precepts that guided our first president in war and peace. It was a little compendium produced by Jesuits in his time.
Yes, and which he'd copied
which
when
he
was
copied as a boy.
As a teenager, yeah.
But he learned that he could not tell a lie.
And other things.
And there then came Alexander Hamilton, American, a fine biography. America's First Dynasty, the Adamses, 1735 to 1918. Gentleman Revolutionary, that's the most recent book, the biography of Gouverneur Morris. And now we have What Would the Founders Do? But what would the founders see? How would we look to them?
Well, obviously they'd be stunned by a lot of the technology and innovations, the good teeth, the fact that we're having this conversation and people are listening to it, hundreds of miles mm-hmm. away. How does that work?
Ben Franklin might not have been as surprised as the others.
Oh, he'd be in your studio, asking questions about the controls
sure.
and all the rest of it. And they would all... I mean, one of their first tasks would be they would all listen to the radio, sit down in front of a television, and sit in front of a screen and figure out the internet. Because they were, I don't think it's too strong to say they were obsessed with the media. And because that is how you put your ideas forth in a republic, where you have to affect popular opinion. And that's how it's done. So they would have to learn it. One thing that struck me in preparing this book, and I sort of knew pieces of it, but it was very striking to see it all kind of put in one place, is the virtual unanimity with which they hoped and expected that the United States would become an empire. And they used that word. I mean, Washington calls it this rising empire. Many times. Hamilton in the first Federalist paper, he says these papers will discuss the fate of an empire, of an interesting empire. Jefferson, writing a letter to Madison when Madison's just become president, says we can be an empire for liberty. Now, on the one hand, we have freed ourselves from the British Empire. And certainly none of these men want us to have an emperor or any other kind of monarch. A few of the the least hopeful ones suspect it may happen down the road, but none of them want that. And yet they hope that we can become a country of imperial extent, I guess we would say a superpower, and yet still have republican institutions.
Does that suggest that they might have approved or resonated positively to the pronouncements from the current administration that our role in the world should be to spread and to protect democracies.
Well, now that's adding an extra element, which is democracy and what sort of value you put on that. And certainly none of them were pure Democrats, with a small d, not one of them. Madison probably...
And when we started, we did not elect them by popular vote.
Well, that's right. Many senators were elected by state legislatures. Many presidential electors were picked by state legislatures. And a lot of that, you know, dividing of the vote and pitting one branch against another still survives, even though popular election has spread. And that's something that the founders designed, and they did it because they thought pure majorities could be as despotic and dangerous as kings or single despots. So they believed that institutions had to rest on a foundation of popular will, they were filtering it and selecting it in different ways so as to make sure that no temporary impulse could possibly overwhelm everything and beat down all opposition in an unjust way. Some of them were what you would call, I think, political anthropologists, in that they thought that our liberties and our system were really only for us. Now, Governor Morris probably has that to the most extreme extent. He's the man who's the draftsman of the Constitution, and then when he's finished with that, he goes to France as a businessman, and he's there from February of 1789 through October of 1794. So he's there from just before the Bastille mm-hmm. falls, really through the depths of the Terror.
Yeah.
He sees the whole early phase of the Revolution, and he never for one moment believes that the French can pull this off. He thinks they're too passionate, they're too headstrong. He likes the French.
Jefferson back home is rooting for the Revolution.
He's
the
rooting
French Revolution.
For it. He's rooting for it. He doesn't bail out until Napoleon comes mm-hmm. along. He sticks with it all through the reign of terror because yeah. he sees our ideals as being similar.
My friend Robespierre,
he says, if the world were left with only a pair, an Adam and Eve, and they were born free, it would be better than it now is. I mean, that's a pretty sweeping and chilling statement. So Morris is the great skeptic, and he says, at one point, he compares the French to a vicious horse pulling a cart. And if you beat it with a stick, you know, it's all right, but it really needs that. On the other hand, I think most of the founders certainly thought that the United States would be an example or an interesting example to the rest of the world. And you get that sense reading the notes of the Constitutional Convention, and especially at moments of deadlock, of which there were many. You have, on one occasion, Alexander Hamilton, on another occasion, Elbridge Gerry. They say words to the effect of, if we fail, we will disappoint the world. You know, and you read that, and on the one hand, you think, what are they talking about? The world is not paying attention to Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. It just wasn't. We're this little country kind of on the edge of nowhere, and they were paying attention to more interesting stuff. And yet, weren't they right? Because we stopped being a little country, we became the empire they expected we would become, and our direct intervention or our example is very attractive or very repulsive to most of the world. So what they were doing turned out to be important. And I think that was the majority view among them, that we were grappling with fundamental issues and eternal problems of political governance, and that we were coming up, you know, with a good shot for humanity, and that would be of interest.
They were politicians, or statesmen, or both. Were they, in essence, better representatives of that genus than we now have working for us?
Well, you know, we have had moments since their passing, I think, when we have reached their level. I think Lincoln reaches their level, and he's very conscious when he's a young man mm-hmm. of the fact that they're all dying off. I mean, he gives a speech in Springfield in 1838 when, Madison has been dead for 2 years and Daniel Carroll, the last signer of the Declaration, has been dead for a year. So the only people left at that point are some ex-privates, and he, and he's conscious that that generation is gone, and he wonders if such people will ever arise again, or if they do, will they be content to work within the system that they've set
up? He warns in that very speech that men of great, as we would say, charisma, who achieve a great public popularity, may very well turn to despotism.
That's right. The tribe of the eagle, he calls them. Right. But, and clearly he's also wondering if Abraham Lincoln is one of these, mm-hmm. Eagles, and clearly he was, and clearly he sought to uphold and stay within that system. And I think, you could make similar arguments of other leaders, like, certainly aspects of Franklin Roosevelt, aspects of Ronald Reagan, showing capabilities and, talents of a high order in very difficult crises.
A major issue facing the country right now, upon which there is great division, even within particularly the Republican, the ruling party, is the illegal immigrants and what the future with regard to immigration from Latin America, particularly from Mexico, will be, how it should be regulated, how much should be allowed. I imagine we might get different responses from different ones among the founders. Who would stand out to have strong opinions on this?
Well, I think they would probably appreciate the irony that we're discussing numbers of people coming here from the former Spanish Empire, when the problem they had, although they saw it as an opportunity, was who's going to get the Spanish Empire? Because clearly Spain is no longer capable of holding on to this vast territory that they had.
Aaron Burr handled his disgrace after slaying Hamilton by getting involved in some sort of wild-eyed scheme to go conquer Mexico, is that right?
Well, that's right, and we still haven't, no one has quite figured out what he was up to, but, clearly that was the part of the world he had his eye on. Not Aaron Burr alone. Jefferson's letter to Madison about the Empire of Liberty, he says, he assumes, well, we'll get Cuba and Canada, mm-hmm. Which we never have. We had Cuba for a few years, and then we let it go again. But so they were very mindful that there was Cuba, Florida, there's Louisiana, which Spain has for a while, and there's Texas beyond that. And even in the founding generation, I mean, they have their eyes on that chunk of the world. The American Army in the Revolution is called the Continental Army, so they're not just intending to stay on the eastern seaboard. So now, in a sense, the shoe is on the other foot. It turns out the Spanish Empire, although it is long gone, was playing a very long game.
And who were the immigrants coming in immediate post-revolutionary times? They were essentially Northern European.
Irish were starting to come.
Yeah.
We already had older communities of Germans and Dutch in Pennsylvania.
And they continued
to
come.
Did they? I don't think the Dutch were continuing to come, and I think the Germans had stopped. But the Irish were really, I mean, the big numbers mm-hmm. wait to the mid-19th century, but the Irish were already starting. And then we had, depending on what was going on in France, we could get, people fleeing one regime or the other. Plus, we did get a number of planters from Haiti when Haiti became independent.
Were they all coming, quote, legally, or were they just crossing the border at night, so to speak?
Well, illegality was not the issue then. I mean, they were coming. The numbers, although, they were relatively large for the time, but they weren't even as large in proportion as they are now. So that wasn't the question. But people did argue about what sort of political habits are they going to bring with them. There's a senator from Massachusetts, Harrison Gray Otis, who gives a speech in Congress, which became kind of notorious, and in the 1790s, and he talks about hordes of wild Irishmen coming here to disturb our tranquility. And you know, Ireland was had tried to revolt from Britain in 1798, and that failed. And so a lot of the would-be rebels had come here, and there was a fear, certainly in the ranks of the Federalist Party, that they'd be bringing rebellious principles with them, and therefore the president should have the power to deport dangerous aliens without a judicial hearing. And this became the Alien Act, which was which John Adams signed. And the Jeffersonians thought this is giving the president much too much power, but they were also appealing to that ethnic vote. You know, already we had the politics of appealing to immigrants and to ethnic communities. And that's one of several reasons why Jefferson beats Adams.
Your earlier book on the WASPs essentially examines and to some and gives two cheers for Anglo-Saxon culture as the ground upon which our national civilization was erected. I mentioned Sam Huntington earlier. As you know, in his last book, Huntington viewed the Mexican, I almost said invasion, but the Mexican migration would be a better term, as one which really might invalidate or challenge or weaken the very value content and the symbolic content of the Anglo-Saxon base upon which this nation was erected and with which it continues. And thus he, Huntington, is very worried about that. Other writers have said similar things. How do you view that?
You mean
speaking
that,
in your own voice
speaking
now,
as myself, not as the channeler as of the founding fathers.
Yeah.
I think we have shown great ability to assimilate people from all parts of the world, but I think it takes time. You know, I think of it as a boa constrictor. I mean, a boa constrictor can eat huge animals, great big wild pigs, you know, but, and I speak, my name is Brookhiser, okay, so that's not a Mayflower name. So the Brookhisers came at, like, in the late 1840s. But it takes time to digest, and then, you know, and then that's fine, and that's ready for a new meal. Now, in the past, a lot of these intervals of quiet were produced by external circumstances. There were wars in Europe, which just, you know, shut off the flow of people. But really beginning in the 20th century, late 19th century, with steamships, travel became so easy and so cheap that you couldn't expect the world to give you your moments of rest. I mean, if you wanted such a thing, you would have to legislate it. Now, you know, we had a big break from the early 20s to the mid-60s. And, you know, there were a lot of bad motives behind that. There was a lot of nativism and racism and all that kind of stuff. But there were also, you know, honest intentions to just, like, slow down for a while. You know, then we've had 40 years of great inflow, and I think it would be time to take another breather.
Last question, time being virtually out. If we take all of the founders that you've studied so closely, about many of whom you've written with a great clarity and with a great enthusiasm, and if time travel were possible, and if America accepted a time traveler from that time to as a new entrant or a re-entrant into American political life, which of them would you like to have running for the presidency?
Well, George Washington, and especially after 9/11. I mean, he's the man for times of trial.
Let's see if we can arrange that. Let's check it out with our scientific friends. Richard Brookhiser has been our guest in this recorded edition. His new book, What Would the Founders Do? Our Questions, Their Answers. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.